Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half hour of interviews on U.S. policy, human rights, the environment, and more. I'm Dori Smith.
One of the advantages that conservatives have had is that people who are conservative media figures like Mr. Lowry tend to think of themselves as part of a cohesive conservative movement.
Our guest today is Paul Waldman of Media Matters. The website of Media Matters is full of audio and text from U.S. radio, TV, and print sources. Our subject today is Richard Lowry, editor of the National Review. He's made some of the more militant statements quoted on MediaMatters.org. Richard Lowry debated The Nation magazine's David Corn on September 13th at Eastern Connecticut State University. The school featured 3 days of educational programs and discussions for students and the general public. We've not been able to obtain audio of this event. However, here is a montage of Richard Lowry speaking at other educational forums.
Iraq is smack dab in the middle of all of them. And once you go into Iraq and establish a fairly decent pro-Western government, Iran will be strategically surrounded on all sides, will be in an ideal position to squeeze that regime, disrupt it. And I think the reformers in Iran will be boosted by what we do in Iraq. Syria, which is a little bit of a nothing country, the two main exports from Syria are terror and pistachio nuts. I prefer the pistachio nuts.
If you take out Granny Winnie, if you take out David Boies, Greg Craig, and all the other trial lawyers, if you take out Al Sharpton and his entourage, if you take out partial birth abortionists, environmental terrorists, anarchist vegetarians, and lesbian avengers, if you take out Alec Baldwin, Daniel Baldwin, Billy Baldwin, Donnie and Marie Baldwin, and Hanging Chad Baldwin, that leaves, through a rough back-of-the-envelope calculation, about 30,000 normal, ordinary, regular Americans who voted for Al Gore. So welcome to the George Bush landslide. With Forbes, what I think he understands is something that the German playwright Bertolt Brecht said long ago. He said when in East Germany, under the communists, when the government lost an election, the government didn't change, the people changed. You know, they'd chase people out and exile them from the country, they'd arrest them, they'd beat them, they'd shoot them. And that's obviously a terrible thing, but there's something to be said for that kind of thinking. I think conservatives need to think in that way when it comes to the American electorate. You can almost define a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court as someone who can't stand the idea that somewhere, someone else is praying. I think there is a war going on in this country against masculinity. I mean, monkeys are violent, nasty little bastards. The average monkey behaves like Al Gore in a debate. There is actually one kind of chimp that is genuinely nonviolent. It's called the bonobo. Now, the bonobo is very interesting. They're nonviolent, as I say. They're vegetarians. They're promiscuous, have sex anytime, anywhere. They're bisexual, and it's a matriarchal society run by the female bonobos. And when I first read about this, I realized this is really the depiction of the ideal liberal society. In fact, it's probably a pretty good description of life at Brown University on any given day.
Paul Waldman, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks. It's good to be with you.
Let's talk about Rich Lowry. He took on David Corn last night at Eastern Connecticut State University. There were some conservative Republican students there, and there were many people who answered Rich Lowry's question about whether or not they were liberal with an affirmative. And so we saw a sea of hands in a large auditorium that kind of, I think, set the tone for the evening. However, I want to ask you, first of all, to describe for our listeners who Rich Lowry is and why he is a person of interest to your group that monitors media.
Well, Rich Lowry is the editor of the National Review, which is one of the oldest and best-established conservative magazines. He also is something of a talking head. He appears on a lot of different shows and makes a lot of public appearances. One of the reasons that we look at him, we monitor the conservative media and the mainstream media to ferret out conservative misinformation. One of the things we've noticed about Lowry is that despite the fact that he often engages in some real sort of over-the-top rhetoric, insults and histrionics and things like that, he's nonetheless, probably in part because he's the editor of, an established magazine, treated as a more perhaps of a mainstream commentator than he deserves. For instance, he often appears on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on PBS, which is supposed to be sort of the home of civilized debate. But Larry is someone who, perhaps not in that forum, but in others, sometimes will get less than civilized. You know, he not long ago made a joke about how in New York they have their Run Hillary Run bumper stickers on the fronts of their cars, making a joke about running Hillary Clinton down with his car. Now, that's something that if a liberal said it, would have gotten a lot of attention and controversy, but I think it's symptomatic of something larger that happens in the mainstream media, which is that there's a tolerance for a kind of extremism and often viciousness on the right that you don't see on the left. And so, you know, to take it to another level, a figure like Ann Coulter, who with regularity threatens to advocates the murder of people that she disagrees with, is you know, on TV practically every night, but there's no one on the left who you know, who would say the kinds of things that she does about killing people and be allowed anywhere near a TV camera.
So to go over the issue of truth versus the some of the kinds of remarks that Richard Lowry made, he characterized the population of Iraq this way: that the vast majority of Shiites and Kurds who were there, who had been getting killed, he said, by the Sunnis, were glad that America is there. Now, I've read a lot of press since the start of the war. Many people don't want America there. It's my understanding that the Kurdish leader, Jalal Talabani, has said he would like U.S. troops to leave and an exit strategy. So how do you address someone who is leading a debate without using the facts and who is sort of, in fact, twisting so many of the details and the facts in what he says that it's hard to address every one of those mischaracterizations?
Well, I think that's always a difficult thing. I mean, that's what we at Media Matters tried to do. There's a, every day there are things that people say on the air and in print that are wrong. And much of the time, whether it's the person who's sitting across from them on a television debate or you know, people who are watching don't happen to have at their disposal the immediate facts that they can use to refute. That's why we at Media Matters have a research team that goes and finds the things out so we can document them. But it's one of the unfortunate facts of the media universe that we live in, that there are there's so much information and so much commentary coming at us on a daily basis. And the process of figuring out whether what people say is true or false is something that takes some time. And so if you don't have the luxury of that time, oftentimes you don't that kind of misinformation can just pass right through into people's eyes and ears. That's one of the real problems that we see with mainstream journalism, is that often they either don't have the time or the inclination to go out and check what the facts are and identify when there is misinformation being passed. That's a real problem. It's what Media Matters tries to address, but it's a monumental task.
Let's talk about the overall media and how it has come to pass that people like Charles Krautheimer or Rich Lowry, who once did research for Krautheimer, have managed to become so prominent, and how their manner of speaking has become part of the standard landscape in U.S. press. When did all of this develop, would you say? Is there a year or a political leader under which this all happened?
Well, it really has its genesis in the 1964 defeat of Barry Goldwater. After that, that was sort of the nadir of conservatism in America. And conservatives decided at that point that they had just suffered this terrible landslide defeat in the presidential election. And they decided that they felt that the mainstream media were arrayed against them, that there was a liberal tilt to the mainstream media, and that major institutions of American society were all controlled by liberals. And so they decided to put a long-term effort into building up what some people have called a counter-establishment, their own think tanks, their own media sources, their own ways of getting their arguments across. And so They began through the 1960s and 1970s and up to today building up these institutions. And now we've reached a point where the institutions that are the best funded and the most aggressive are on the right. So you have think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and the Hoover Institution and the American Enterprise Institute that regularly churn out people who are skilled at appearing in media and getting published. You have this entire conservative media that's grown up, not only magazines, which, you know, there are conservative magazines and liberal magazines, but the conservative domination of talk radio, the Fox News Channel, this entire alternate media that's relentlessly pushing the Republican line, and that creates this kind of a din. On the other side, liberals don't really have that. If you ask conservatives, they'll say, oh, well, the counter to Fox News is CNN, which is a little bit ridiculous. There's nothing on CNN that is anything like the kind of cheerleading that goes on Fox News for the Republican cause. And so you have this mainstream media that's constantly trying to show how objective it is being countered by a conservative media that is the propaganda arm of the Republican Party. And the liberal equivalent is, a few magazines and websites and things that are pretty far outgunned. But it's because the conservatives invested a couple of decades and many hundreds of million dollars in building up this counter-establishment on their side that they were so successful in pushing forward their people and getting their arguments into the public debate.
I want to ask about the use of certain code language, taglines, the use of phrases that might start with one person like Richard Lowry and sort of go across the nation quickly. He used the term, for example, virtuous circle. And he said, until Hurricane Katrina, we were seeing the deficit go down. And when economies grow, they throw off revenues and that this grows the economy. My understanding of what is happening to the deficit is that it's going up and that people are very, very worried about it. So there was this sort of twisting of the facts, don't you think?
Well, it's always easy to do that, especially when you're talking about things like budget deficits, because you can leave unstated the answer to the question compared to what. So we had a budget surplus during the Clinton years. Then very quickly, with the first couple of Bush budgets and tax cuts, we went back into deficit. Recently, the government announced that the deficit was going to be slightly smaller than some previous projections had claimed, and that's probably what Lowry was referring to. Now that we may spend somewhere between $100 and $200 billion cleaning up from Hurricane Katrina, we're going to go back into a severe deficit. When he talks about the deficit going down, you know, that can be true in a narrow sense, but give you a misleading impression. And hopefully in a context like that, when he's debating someone like David Corn, who's very knowledgeable about the issues, there's someone there to clarify things and to counter those arguments. The problem is that oftentimes there isn't, whether it's on television or in print. Those kinds of misleading statements can be bandied about without anyone being there to correct them.
So when Rich Lowry said things like that the inspectors were only back in Iraq just prior to the U.S. invasion because of the military threat, when in fact David Corn had just pointed out the course of their presence in Iraq, and others have certainly described the reality of that, which is more that, you know, Saddam Hussein was indeed trying to get away with what he could, but he also had the rational sense that that the inspectors and the results of the inspections were basically going to reveal the facts, which were that nothing was present for them to see.
And that was really the danger, and that's why the Bush administration was so opposed to having inspections. When it comes to Iraq, there has been a tremendous rewriting of history all through the process, even before the war started and ever since. And I think that particularly with when it comes to people on the right who supported the war, because things have gone so badly, they become increasingly desperate to justify their original and ongoing support for it. So saying things like, you know, the majority of the Iraqi people really want the United States there, it's almost that those are things that they would like to believe and convince themselves of, whether there's any kind of justification for it at all.
What Rich Lowry said, though, was that the example of what the invasion and occupation, and of course he's talking about the democracy that's there in Iraq, what that did was to inspire the Lebanese people to demonstrate and try to win their own democracy.
Well, in that case, you're talking about attributing causes to events, which are something that can be debated, and some people will have more justification for their interpretation than others. But ultimately, it's not possible in that kind of a case to say definitively that the reason there were demonstrations in Lebanon was or was not because of the example of Iraq. That's something that's going to be very hard to demonstrate, especially quickly. And so you can, you know, different people can have different interpretations, and some of them will just be more plausible than others. But the test is, can you justify it? Can you support your arguments with facts? And so, you know, even if you think that his argument is ridiculous, you know, even ridiculous arguments are going to get out there. Hopefully, people will be paying enough attention that people will then be called to say, okay, you know, you've made this claim that you know, the example of the Iraqi election is what inspired things to happen in other countries. Can you support that with anything? And it's in the answer to that question where hopefully one side's argument becomes clearer to be closer to the truth than the others. But that is always going to be something that will happen as we are continuously interpreting history as it's happening. And so, of course, people who support the Iraq War would like to attribute everything that they think is positive to the effects of the Iraq War and dismiss anything that is negative as being as a result of the Iraq War. And the inverse is true on the other side. So, again, the test is whether or not you can support those claims. You know, you may hear that claim and say, that's just ridiculous. And if he can't offer any particular evidence that that's the truth, then it is ridiculous and it should be rejected. The only unfortunate thing is that most people don't pay close enough attention to the news, and the news often doesn't contain enough details of those debates for regular people to really sort out the true from the false and the plausible from the absurd. So that is just one of the unfortunate consequences of the age in which we live.
Now, Richard Lowry started out the evening by explaining that he didn't work for the Republican National Committee, didn't work for the Bush administration. Let's talk about the politics of what he represents. I, for one, would have enjoyed asking him at that moment whether or not it was part of his job, or he saw it as part of his job, to help build up the numbers of conservative Republican students in America, or the conservative Republican movement that Karl Rove always identifies?
Well, you know, I think that we have to understand that people, even people you vehemently disagree with and think are engaging in unfair debate, are probably doing it because they believe in their cause. And this is something that's true on both sides of the aisle. I sometimes get people who will, you know, write to me saying things like, how much is the Democratic Party paying you? And of course, they're not paying me anything. You know, I advocate what I do because it's what I happen to believe, and I think the same is probably true of him. One of the advantages that conservatives have had is that people who are conservative media figures like Mr. Lowry tend to think of themselves as part of a cohesive conservative movement, and that is something that combines not only conservative media but also people in the White House on Capitol Hill, people in think tanks, and they all feel as though they are on the same team and pushing for the same goals. So. On the other side, that has not been true as much on the left. The left is starting to get its act together a little bit, but they have not had the kind of coordination that the right has been able to accomplish. And the consequence of that is that the right's message is much more coherent and unified. And so you'll hear the same thing being said by media figures on the right and by the White House and by people on Capitol Hill and by people in think tanks. They're all singing from the same hymnal. And on the left, the message tends to be much more fractured because people think of their allegiance not as being so much to a coherent, larger movement of progressivism. Now, again, that is something that the left is trying to emulate what the right has done and get its act together a little bit. We'll have to see over the course of the next few years whether they're successful.
Richard Lowry used Hillary Clinton's name when answering at least seven questions that I counted, In several of those answers, he also provided details about John Kerry and John Edwards, and so deflected the conversation to talking about specific Democrats.
Well, Hillary Clinton is a bête noire for the right. They tend to believe that she is evil incarnate, and they look on her, you know, her ordinary ambitions that any politician has as somehow being more sinister. You know, let's say Bill Frist is thinking about running for president, and Hillary Clinton maybe as well, but somehow the right believes that the fact that Hillary Clinton is running for president is evidence of something truly evil. You know, that's partly sexism, that's partly just a product of the way that the right tended to think of the Clintons, which is tied up with a whole series of things about the effect of the 1960s on our political culture. For many on the right, Hillary and Bill Clinton came to represent what they saw as the evils of the 1960s, about sexual libertinism and the whole counterculture. The fact that they were not really a part of that wasn't really relevant. But one of the things that the right tends to do is it usually needs enemies. And for a long time, communism was the enemy, and these supposed communists are in our midst. And now, frankly, the Clintons are the enemy. And that's going to continue to be true. The 2008 election will be about character and individuals, and that's one of the things that the Democrats always get wrong, is they think that elections are about issues, and that if you just put forward your 10-point plan and you have a really good 10-point plan, then the people will elect you. And then the Republicans come along and tell people that it's all about character and that the Democrat is evil and weak and wants to destroy our country and leave your children open to terrorist attack, and the Republicans win because they understand what really matters in elections, and Democrats don't. So yes, you know, the elections of 2006 and 2008 will be about individual Democrats and what the Republicans will say are the deficiencies in their character. And if the Democrats don't start to understand that, then they're going to continue to lose.
We're talking with Paul Waldman, and you can find information about his organization online, Media Matters. We're talking about Richard Lowry. He was debating David Corn at a program, Iraq Perspectives, Tuesday, September 13th, and this event was sponsored by Eastern Connecticut State University. I do want to talk with you about the phenomenon of people like Lowry coming onto college campuses, because I know on August 5th of this year, Lowry spoke before a much more friendly audience, and he shared the podium with people like Ann Coulter, and was much more, I would have to say, militant sounding, extreme sounding with those friendly audiences than with the kind of audience that he encountered here in Connecticut. I just want to ask you about colleges and whether or not you feel that they have really looked into people like Lowry before inviting them to their campuses to understand who they are and what kinds of things they say when they're not polishing up their act as scholars.
Well, I think in this case, they probably wanted to have a lively debate, and they chose two people who they felt were roughly similar. David Corn writes for The Nation, and Lowry writes for National Review. Both of them appear on television. And I think that in that context, having a debate is something where, you know, if Lowry says something that's not true, then Corn, who's very knowledgeable, can correct him. I think that oftentimes, you know, universities want to bring people who are going to generate interest, and sometimes that means bringing on some fairly irresponsible characters. Now, you know, Lowry has said some awful things, but he's far from the worst offender on the right, and there are plenty of people who have consistent bookings on college campuses around the country who really are purveyors of hate, and that's the business that they're in. And I think that colleges are sometimes interested in having people who are controversial just because it generates interest. And one of the things that conservatives have done well is that they often will pay the fees for people like Ann Coulter to come to a college campus. They're very interested in organizing on campuses and helping young conservatives to set up campus newspapers, to organize their clubs. And what you find therefore on many college campuses is that there are a lot more liberals. But the conservatives are much better organized, and they have access to a Washington-based establishment that will help them organize and advocate on campus, whereas the liberals tend to be sort of disconnected, and they don't have that support. And so even though the liberals outnumber the conservatives often are much more effective at what they do.
The National Review Book Service features a book called Start the Presses, a handbook for student journalists by Ridgely Stanley. They call for young warriors for liberty across America and instruct students on where to turn for money, what to do if schools oppose you. Richard Lowry calls the book an absolutely indispensable startup guide for aspiring conservative journalists who hope to take on the liberal academy from within. So this would sort of go to your statement here about how conservative Republican movements are sweeping college campuses and why.
Yeah, well, that's something that they've spent a lot of time thinking about and put a lot of energy and money into, because they have understood that they're in it for the long term and that their movement has goals that don't just have to do with the current Congress or the next election, but go over decades. And so part of being an effective movement in that way is building up the next generation of leaders. And so they do that with training, with internships, with helping young conservatives who want careers in Washington and in conservative advocacy to get a jump start on that career and get good connections. Again, this is one of the many things that conservatives have done very, very well over the last couple of decades, and liberals are now finally starting to think about putting some energy into.
On your website, that's at mediamatters.org, you have a featured story about Pat Robertson, who has apparently claimed that Storm Katrina was God's omen and punishment for the United States. Pat Robertson, as we know, basically threatened the life of the elected leader of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, and then again with Rich Lowry saying, quote, lots of sentiment for nuking Mecca. Moderates, he said, opt for something more along these lines. Baghdad and Tehran would be the likeliest sites for a first strike. If we have clean enough bombs to assure a pinpoint damage area, Gaza City and Ramallah should also be on the list. Damascus, Cairo, Algiers, Tripoli, and Riyadh should be put on alert that any signs of support for the attacks in their cities will bring immediate annihilation. That's quoting Richard Lowry. He's also made some very strange comments about contacting the EPA to find out what their mandate is on environmentally correct toilets, wondering aloud before a student audience how it is possible to flush a Quran down the toilet. All of these words and the nature of the anger in them and the use of force implied, how is it that this moral or group that came to power calling themselves the moral leaders in any political debate are able to use that kind of language, Paul Waldman, and get away with it? And what kind of an impact is that having?
Well, part of it is because a lot of it flies under the radar. Until Media Matters started publicizing some of the things that Pat Robertson did, even though he's a major figure in the Republican Party, a lot of people didn't really pay attention to him outside of his actual listeners. Now, the 700 Club, his television show, has somewhere around a million viewers. There are lots of other conservative media sources that people in the mainstream media don't really pay attention to. And so a lot of this extreme rhetoric happens in those sources, and it never really goes beyond there. So people listen to it, and there are certainly plenty of people who feel like we should, you know, bomb the entire Arab world. And those people who are sympathetic to that hear those messages, but the rest of us tend most of the time not even to know that it's going on. And that's part of the reason it's powerful. Now, Robertson has of late gotten in some trouble because Media Matters can help take credit for this, when he made those comments about advocating the assassination of Hugo Chavez, the president of Venezuela, we put up an item about it on our website and told reporters about it, and most reporters probably don't watch the 700 Club, and so they would never have known. Then it began to get some attention, and Republicans felt they had to distance themselves from him, and he was discredited all over America. That shows that if you actually shine the light on some of this stuff, then people begin to react against it. But unfortunately, there is an audience for that, and there are plenty of people who who are open to the kinds of things in those, like in that quote from Lowry that you read about all the different cities in the Arab world we were going to nuke, and we wonder why there's so much anti-American feeling toward us and why there are so many people who are willing to become terrorists and want to kill Americans.
Paul Waldman, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure.
Paul Waldman is a senior fellow at Media Matters, a group that monitors the conservative and mainstream media, tracking misinformation or bias. MediaMatters.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program was produced in the studios of WHUS Stores, radio for the people at the University of Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNation.org for discussion and transcripts.